Crew.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
Yay! All right, thank you, Dusty. Thank you. All right,
very
good. Very good. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to All About Wine. This is June 17th, 2021, 7:01 p.m. 79 degrees Fahrenheit, rain, and let's see what else. That's it. So,
thank you for calling.
Thanks. Good night. we got a guest coming up tonight here, Ramon Escobar from Shoefly Imports, and he's going to talk to us about his history and Bolivian wines. That's what the import is more than anything. It was Bolivian wines, and so this should be interesting. Shoefly.
You said C-H-O-O was how it's pronounced, which is chew.
Q. You're right. Shoefly, not shoe. Q. Shoefly.
We were talking about it a year ago. I wonder how you pronounce it. And you came up with you found it on a site somewhere, and it was C-H-O-O, fly. No. And I thought, hey, that's chew. And then we get on there, and it's a totally different thing.
Yeah. Shoefly, yeah. And the emphasis is on the fly, that's good. Let's see, where am I? Geez,
maybe he's calling, and we can find out for sure.
Yeah,
I have no idea. It's like a 20-digit phone number here. Hold on a second.
Where is he calling? Yeah, geez. 525. Oh my gosh, he must be calling from another country. Well, why don't we just bring him on and find out?
We'll bring him on.
Yeah.
Be surprised together.
All right. Hey, Ramon, welcome to All About Wine.
Hey, how's it going?
Going
great.
Can
you hear me well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we can hear you.
Good.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Mexico City, actually. I overheard you guys wondering what this long number was about.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we've never seen that. That's why, because we've never gotten a call from Mexico City. That's why we've never seen it that long. Yeah. Oh, very good. So, thanks for being on tonight. Mike and I were discussing Shoefly, right? Or is it Shoefly?
Shoefly, yeah. No, you got it. You nailed it.
Shoefly. Okay. That's good. So to begin with, I want you to tell me your history. How did you come about to be the founder of Shoefly Imports? What led you up to this? And I know you've been in politics for a long time, which is not usually a standard step to get into wine and export. So what is the
Isn't
history
that the
of that?
Truth?
Yeah,
yeah, that's the truth. I often feel like the dumbest person in the room whenever I get around some knowledgeable wine folk. And I certainly know my place and the business is gross. It's certainly not true wine. luckily we've got a whole bunch of great people that help on that stuff.
Good.
Yeah, so I came to wine through international affairs and economic development. I was, I do have a little bit of a wine, I wouldn't say pedigree, that's probably an exaggeration, but my grandfather is from, on my mom's side, is from Wisconsin.
Oh.
He was a farmer and, you know, had a little garden and, you know, just kind of blue collar, rural Wisconsin family, of Norwegian stock. And they immigrated before the Civil War. We still have, like, actually the plot of land that the original Norwegian immigrants came over, when they came over, they bought. We still have it in our family, which is pretty cool.
That's cool.
Yeah. But my grandpa made some sweet wines, you know, let's just call them that. They were wines that were not, you know, very sophisticated or anything, but, you know, he made them. And so he would always make them in his basement and stuff like that. And I'd say that was probably my first experience with wine. As a kid, you know. But I didn't really have a profound appreciation for fine wine. Like, that wasn't where I came from. I came from understanding that economic development projects around the world failed really, you know, far more frequently than they succeeded. And I spent some time in Bolivia, which is the other half of my heritage. My dad immigrated from Bolivia, and it turns out Bolivia has a pretty unique and incredible wine history and wine tradition, which we can get into if you guys want to later.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, it struck a chord with me. And so I spent a lot of time in sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America looking at sales development projects and coming to a pretty clear conclusion that you got to have a market for a product at the first step before you really want to, you know, change an economy. And secondly, that product ought to be include a whole value chain behind it. And so that there's room for people to rise up, you know, social upward mobility. The sad truth of a lot of commodity exports from the developing world is that, you know, although you can live a life of dignity through fair trade coffee or fair trade quinoa or something like that, your kid's probably going to also pick coffee beans and also pick quinoa and not really climb up the value chain, right? Wine is this beautiful agricultural good, this very rare agricultural good where there's a whole value chain attached to it, attached to the grape. And there you have like all sorts of new opportunities for growth so that the kids, you know, the parents who are picking grapes as laborers, their kids aren't necessarily hamstrung into that in that same role through the whole, their, you know, through generation after generation. And we actually have stories in our own, in the wineries that we work with that are very inspirational about how the next generation has been able to move up into different roles in the winery and improve the quality of their lives. And so that was kind of how I got to this whole thing. And, you know, I'm not afraid to go to countries that are maybe a little off the beaten track. I've served in Iraq and Saudi Arabia. I was in the peace negotiations with the FARC guerrillas. And, you know, I've been all around the world. I just got back from Honduras actually last week. And so like, you know, discovering all these interesting winemaking traditions around the world in countries that are kind of off the radar, that might be a little bit, you know, intimidating for a lot of people, but who have really beautiful wines to share with the world. And so linking all that up together is kind of how I fell into wine.
Interesting. How many, and just as a side here, how many languages do you speak?
I speak Spanish, English, French, and Arabic.
Oh, okay. Quite.
Although my Arabic is rusty. My wife would tell you that my Arabic needs a lot of work. It's been a while since I spoke in Arabic.
And your wife is from where?
She's American, but of Syrian descent. And she also believes that she can speak better Spanish than I can, which I probably wouldn't.
Whoa. Yeah. All right. Yeah. That's pretty sketchy of her. That is on your website. I noticed this Shoofly website. That is your partner there that we see.
Yeah, that's not my wife. That's my partner, T. Lai Long. Yeah. She's part of the family though. Yeah.
Okay.
So she was we're a very family oriented company. When Tilai joined, she was a junior in college at GW University in Washington. And I was on paternity leave from the State Department with my firstborn. And that was kind of when I started planting the seeds. I had done a couple of exploratory trips to Bolivia to talk to the wineries and kind of lay out, you know, hey, this is what I think we can do. I don't have a lot of experience in wine, but I think this story will be compelling. And they sort of signed up with me. And then I realized quickly with the help of some of my partners that, yeah, you have a full-time job as a diplomat. You can't really be running a wine company.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think that, you know. I'm going, wait a minute. You need to choose here. Yes.
So I put out some ads in the local D.C. Universities and said, hey, I need somebody who's 21 years old who wants to transform economies around the world through wine and spirits. I pay. And in Washington, that's a big deal, you know, because the government doesn't pay anybody. Including me, I sometimes feel. So I was offering to pay people, and I got a lot of interest. And Tilai was, we were very fortunate that Tilai joined us. And I mentioned Tilai always in the context of my family because as I said, I was on paternity leave. So I had a brand new little boy infant who I continue to be madly in love with. And
they do that.
Yeah, they do that to you, right? And she was the first person who was not a relative to watch my kid. And she's very, very tight with me and my wife and my family. We're all a big family. So she's actually doing a tasting tonight with the GW alumni group. Her son.
Oh, very good.
It's funny. But anyways, that's Tilai.
And that's another problem Mike and I had trying to pronounce it. We can come out now. What is her nationality? Tilai.
She's American. She's as American as apple pie. Yeah, from Pennsylvania.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And she describes it as in her own words. I was born to two hippie parents who loved this book about a Native American woman, and that was her name was Tilai, and so they named her after this character.
We get a lot of Americans that are born to hippie parents that have weird names now. So, yeah. Hey, that's cool. Let's try this name. And I go, oh, okay. Yeah. And the kids are stuck with it for the rest of their life. Yeah. Tilai, that's sort of an interesting name, though. So you're starting to tell me the story of, you know, starting the business, all that. Just continue on there.
So the crux of it is that for us, for me and our sort of founding team, who we are all sort of mission oriented, for us it was just clear that wine was a means to an end. And for us the end was empowering people to transform their local economies. And and it just so happens that wine is a delicious means, right? I mean, like, let's be honest here. Like, I'm very fortunate, I think, that I didn't, you know, fall upon, I don't know, some boring, you know, like paper cups, you know? Like, because, I mean, if that was the thing that was going to drive development in the countries that I was looking at, that's what I would have gone for, because the end goal for me is development. I'm just very, very lucky. My wife is very grateful because she loves fine wine. Really good, high quality wines happen to be a great means to driving this, to getting to this end of driving development. And so, that was kind of how we got started. And we spent the first 2 years really just trying to understand, you know, looking at Bolivia as sort of the pilot. It's probably the most difficult country you could ever imagine wanting to start a wine company in, you know. I mean, it's the poorest country in South America. It has very poor infrastructure. The last 2 years have seen tremendous amount of social and political unrest. It's landlocked. There's not even a port. And it's in very rough terrain, right? You know, it's in the Andes Mountains. And so we figured that if we can do it here, we can kind of do it anywhere, right? And And, you know, and then it just so happens, it helps a lot, I think, that Bolivia does have this remarkable wine tradition, almost 500 years now of a winemaking history that no one knows about. And being able to share that to the world and really show that there is these knockout, knock your socks off quality wines coming from this region that produces about 1.5% of the wine that Argentina produces in terms of volume is really, really fascinating. And so that's what we set out to do. And we really started with the restaurant industry and finding champions there for us to, one, validate the quality of the product. That was really important to us. Like one of the, as I kind of looked into this and just understood, the wine and spirits industry, one of the big mistakes that often countries will make in this sector is try to compete on price alone and become and sort of pigeonhole themselves into this value category that's really hard to shake. The big example for folks in my generation, Gen Xers, is tequila. Everybody in my generation and probably even before me assume that tequila is a terrible, low-quality spirit, right? Because of the experiences we had in college, And in fact, it's not. It's this incredible premium spirit when it's actually done right that is meant for sipping and is just really high quality. Well, it took 30, 40 years for that trend to reverse, in the U.S. to kind of correct that mistake. Rum saw a similar experience. And I think, to a lesser degree, but still, I think there's something to be said about Chilean and Argentinian wine of sort of, really competing on that on the price point and a little bit too much that sort of, hamstrung them a little bit. I think that obviously there's incredible Argentinian and Chilean wines that stand up toe to toe with any fine wine from around the world. There's just sort of this cachet, that kind of stuck with it. And so as part of our, impact thesis is just, we want to maintain that ability of being differentiable. And since the production levels are so low in Bolivia, you just can't compete on price. The economies of scale are just not there. One large winery in Argentina produces more wine than the whole darn country, Bolivia.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just not a place that we can play. So, and that's going to be the truth for almost any developing country that is, emerging wine country, winemaking country, And so that's kind of where we focus is like, all right, let's go around and show people that this is a really high quality wine that can command a price and go toe to toe with some of the fine wines around the world. And we did that about more than nine of our products, but our products, our portfolio of wine and spirits were featured in 9 Michelin star restaurants.
Wow.
And we've been in our first placement of a wine was Bottomless to Not, which is a fantastic wine. We're always sold out of it. We can't keep it in stock. It's a phenomenal to not. And it was the first placement I ever got was that wine and bourbon steak at the Four Seasons. And it was the year they were selected as James Beard finalists for best wine list in the country. So we're talking like serious, serious quality, right? None of these people mess around with their wine list. You can't pay to get on them and like as if we had money to pay anybody. But so that was a big part of the first 2 years was just kind of like saying, okay, are these wines good? Because we don't want to go into this business if we have to compete on price because there's no way that these developing countries are going to be able to do that. That's an unwinnable war, right? With the Edie and Jay Gallows of the world, the wine groups, the treasuries, there's zero chance we can compete with them on price. And especially with the dominance of the bulk wine kind of in the industry right now. And so we really had to differentiate on quality and be able to set ourselves apart. And so that's what we did. And kudos to Pilai, my partner, who did the knocking on the doors and the rolling of the eyes when you say Bolivian wine and just getting through all that and then just wowing people with just the bottle and then we bring in the story, right? And then we come in with these amazing stories about impact, about tradition, about history and economics and all of a sudden you're just wowing people. You're like, wow, the juice is good, but the story's better, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we wanted to do, is validate this idea with Bolivia. We feel very confident we did. I mean, we're 100% convinced on the quality. That part is now kind of, we're past that piece so that we don't have to worry about that anymore. In fact, one of the people that is, we call her our chief portfolio curator, is the former wine director for Maidan, which is a Michelin star restaurant.
Oh.
Very, very, very nice restaurant. And she helps us curate. And we have a really elaborate matrix on evaluation. We evaluate things such as impact, like different impact factors, sustainability, workforce empowerment, all these different things. And then we look at the quality, so the technical aspects of the wine, like how high quality is it? And then we look at the partnership factors, like are these wineries that we want to partner with? Because we'll be very selective in our portfolio always as we expand to new regions. And so, so it's just been really fun. We're learning along the way. And more recently, we've realized that, you know what, we've got to communicate more directly to our consumer, because we really truly believe, and this is another piece of sort of what we've learned, is that the consumer is this is what they want. You know, they're not going to sacrifice quality. You know, they want a good wine always, but they want to know that their purchasing dollars are actually doing some good in the world, and they want to see wine as a way to, you know, share stories and discover new regions. I mean, like one thing that we love to talk about in Chufla is how how wine is a window to different cultures. You know, it's a great path. It's a great means to discover, you know, entire countries, regions, culinary traditions. Like you really can use wine as this beautiful tool to see the world. You know, that's what we do. Like we're focused on wines that are largely undiscovered, and that's going to always be the case. You know, as we start to continue to add new regions to our platform, to Chufly, there'll always be interesting stories behind them. There'll always be really fun discoveries to make.
And that's so important, the stories behind it, too. I say that firsthand because when I had the winery, we would have wines, but I would have a story for each one of them and tell about each one.
That's right.
And yeah, even on a small scale like that, people like to hear the stories. That's one of the good things about going to a winery, and that's why this past year and a half has been so rough on wineries, because people like to hear the stories. They want to know a little bit behind the wine and what it's about and all that. So that's very important.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And you know, and I think too that, like, you know, even taking that a step further, it's just like, it's hard to humanize a lot of, you know, consumables in our lives, right? You know, like it's hard to humanize, like, you know, I don't know, like, a soda pop or even a beer.
But just about anything, actually, if you think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, really. I mean, a lot of stuff. You know, it's hard to humanize it. But wine is this beautiful thing because there's a winemaker behind that one.
Right.
And there's some people, there's a whole collective of people that pick those grapes, right, and put them in that thing. And they're all like, you know, it's relatable. What is the term that I'm thinking of? It's romantic, you know, like it's a romantic industry, right? And it takes you to a place that who wouldn't want to sit on a winery and watch the sunset, right?
Exactly.
I think that there's a lot of that. And, you know, in Bolivia, it's been fun because we've now got three new grape varietals that have never been registered with the U.S. authorities registered.
Really?
We've got two new regions, winemaking regions that were never, two new appellations, domain of origin that were never, ever recognized by the U.S. government. We've got them. Like, that's the kind of stuff that we want to do. You know, we want to bring new stuff there. There's a grape that we're going to bring in. It'll be only available with our wine club, but it's very teeny tiny production. But there's this, it's about 8,000 feet above sea level. It's in this Red Canyon, and it's actually in an offshoot of this Red Canyon, and it's called the Canyon of the Sintes. And it takes about 2.5 hours to get there on this like gravel mountain road that I would probably not take my kids on. I'm a little bit of a nervous dad. And you get to the end of this road, and there's literally you wouldn't even know what you were looking at until someone told you. But there's literally a forest of grapes. What it is these grapevines that are hundreds of years old have just intertwined with the trees in this forest. And mm-hmm. there are quince trees and peppercorn trees and fig trees and citrus trees. It's absolutely magic. Like, there's nothing like it on the face of the planet that I'm aware of. And there's literally hundreds of vines that are growing on this. And the grapes are predominantly this native varietal, native in the strict definition of the term in the wine world, in the viticultural world, native varietal called Bistrocania that only grows in this valley. And it's a very light grape. It's beautiful. The clusters have both red and white grapes in the same cluster. Wow. It's a phenomenal grape that's probably sort of spawned maybe 300 years ago or so. And we're going to bring in the first bottles of that ever in the history of the United States. So it's pretty exciting.
It sounds
it's really beautiful stuff. They literally pick the grapes by climbing the trees. They have to climb the trees, and they have these baskets on their back. I've seen it. It's incredible. This is the thing. You know, when you discover new regions, you learn about all these new traditions and histories, and, you know, that's the only way to find out. You got to get there.
Well, you think South America. You immediately think Chile and Argentina. That's pretty much it. I mean, you know, Bolivia doesn't even come to mind as a secondary or tertiary or even further down the line of a country that's going to be growing grapes. I mean, you understand that as well as anyone. So, you know, I understand your introduction, your dad coming from there. But Bolivian wines, in your site here, says they've been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's not known. So how many regions, how many regions are in Bolivia that grow wine? What type of grapes? How many different types of grapes are grown there? And what is the profile of the wine from that region? I mean, I know it's landlocked, but obviously there's mountains and there's lowlands and everything. So I'm going to let you really educate us on Bolivian wines here.
Sounds great. Yeah. So, okay. So the hundreds of years piece, the origin of Bolivian wine is like anywhere else in the New World, right? It came with the European conquest of the Americas, and they brought the grapes over with them. Bolivia's story gets unique because of the massive silver mine. I think it was at one point the largest silver mine in the world. It's called Cerro Rico, and it's in a town called Potosí. So that town and that mountain in the 16th century, early 16th century, was at the time the wealthiest city in the world because it just had so much silver. Yeah, and it was it's really, really impressive. Its history and all that. And so obviously where there's wealth, there's people. And where there's people, especially in colonial times, there's the aristocracy that comes with it. Well, the problem with Potosí and Cerro Rico is that it's about 14,000 feet above sea level. So that would be like trying to live on top of Pikes Peak. It's not a very hospitable place. The only thing you're growing up there is quinoa and potatoes. Definitely not grapes. And so when, the Jesuits and the Franciscans and the Dominicans arrived, you know, wanting to make wine for mass, they had to go down into the lower valleys. And the first valley that they settled in most likely in that area was the Sinti Valley, which is this canyon I was telling you about. It's at a mere 8,200 feet above sea level.
Quick question here.
Yeah.
Bolivia, does the equator run through the center of Bolivia?
No, but it's all tropical. So the equator runs right above the northern part of it. But the entire country is tropical. And so great question. And that is a great segue into the elevation piece. So because of the fact that Bolivia is literally a tropical country, and that 40% of its land mass is actually the Amazon rainforest.
Oh, wow.
You can't even and then 10% of it is the altiplano, so that's 14,000 feet above sea level, and then the rest of it is mountain valleys, right? There's a little bit of a savanna piece towards Paraguay and Argentina, but the biggest sort of chunk of Bolivian landmass is the Amazon rainforest. And then you have a really big chunk of valleys, right? And so the valleys, of course, is where you get these microclimates, because the Andes Mountains are, massive. So, you know, you're talking the highest peak in Bolivia is 21,000 feet, right? And so so between, you know, the rainforest, which is essentially, you know, sea level, to Iyimani, which is 21,000 feet, between there you have all these valleys. So the thing about the funny thing, so you guys probably know this, and I bet you a lot of your listeners know this stuff, you know, the elevation, average elevation in Bordeaux is, you know, what is it, a couple hundred feet, 200 feet above sea level.
Yeah, not much, yeah.
And then you go to Napa, and you're looking, I think the average is somewhere around 1,200 feet above sea level. Mendoza, if that, right? And then you get to Mendoza, and you're averaging at about 2,900 feet above sea level. Bolivia's wine country starts at 5,200 feet above sea level.
Oh, my gosh.
It starts at 5,200 feet.
So,
you know, you can always find the one-off, you know, winery that, you know, in random countries like around the world, you can find that one-off winery. Well, we're at, you know, 8,000, 9,000 feet. And it's like, okay. But are all of your wineries at 5,000? It's really remarkable. And so there you have it, my friend. This is what sort of makes Bolivian wine so interesting and unique, is that all of the wine is affected by extreme elevation. And so the winemakers there, their big challenge is to take these grapes and figure out how to make, you know, really unique and spectacular wines in this very hostile environment, right? For your following, I think folks will appreciate this. The other beauty of elevation is that your shift in temperature between, you know, the hottest and lowest point of the day and you know, the day and the evening, is very extreme. So because of elevation, you have very thin atmosphere. So the heat's not trapped during the day, but the thin atmosphere allows for really intense UV rays to come in when the sun's up. And so that thinner atmosphere forces the grapes to develop thicker skins to protect themselves from the UV rays. And then they also face that greater stress from the temperature change. And what you end up having is extremely intense aromas, aromatics, flavors. You have softened tannins, more rounded tannins naturally through that because of those factors. And you get some really interesting things. So you get I think one of the funnest things, and in fact, there's we got a couple of whites that do this, but the Magnus Muscatel right now is just really, really, really fun in this way. I always tell people you get a twofer when you drink a Bolivian white wine, because you get on the nose, you're anticipating a sweet, fruity, just kind of like intense aroma, right? Aromatic. And you're kind of like, oh, okay, this is going to be a sweet wine, pretty wine. All right. And then you drink it, and it's bone dry. It's just absolutely bone dry. And you're like, what? That is not what was supposed to just happen. My nose did not agree with that.
That's
I did not
wrong.
Prepare my tongue for that taste. And it's because of the acidity. That's the other piece that the elevation brings in. The acidity sort of rips through that.
Yeah, I shouldn't say that. That elevation, that temperature, that's really going to affect the acid on the wine too. Yeah.
That's right. So anyway, there's some unique characteristics about Bolivian wine. They've been largely producing for their own domestic consumption since, you know, they started producing grapes in the 16th century. And then when we started exporting it, we were basically the first commercial exporters to take it out. And,
wow.
And especially to the U.S., there was always, you know, there's been little orders here and there that went out to like an Bolivian expat that was living somewhere and he would order a bunch or, you know, kind of a, you know, like a, someone who was doing it for the novelty would bring in, you know, like a pallet or something here and there. But, it,
right.
you know, for us, we've brought in now, what have we done? 5,000, over 5,000 cases of Bolivian wine we've put into the United States. Yeah.
5,000 cases.
That's real.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So how many growing regions are there in Bolivia?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
where do you get your wines from, you know, from each region or, and how many
yeah.
wineries are in each region? I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are three predominant wine growing regions. The biggest by far, just by number of wineries, number of bottles, everything. And on land area is Tarija, which is probably the least surprising area because it's the state that borders Argentina. And so, although it's a very different terroir, but still, you know, it makes sense, right, to the average person. And so you just kind of keep climbing north along that mountain chain that from, you know, Mendoza, Salta, then up to Tarija. And so they have the most production, right? So we're looking at, we work with Magnus, Aranjuez, Concepcion, and we're going to bring in Altasama now. So we're going to bring in four wines from that. I'm working with four wineries from that region. And there's probably, I'd say, commercial winery, not just like, you know, making it for their family. Maybe like 15 or 20.
Wow.
And then maybe a few more than that, actually. But, you know, there's, you know, a lot of it is pretty informal. And then the most traditional region is the one I was talking about, the Sinti region, which is this canyon. And so Tarija is like, think of it as kind of like a Mediterranean climate. It has a, sort of a sandy soil. It's about 5,200 to 6,500 feet above sea level. There's mm-hmm. two principal valleys there, sub-valleys, the Santa Ana Valley and the Concepcion Valley. We have wineries from both. And then the Sinti Valley is above Tarija. You have to go up a mountain. It's this long drive. It's a very beautiful drive. And you go up onto the altiplano. There's a little altiplano up there, like a little plateau, and then that plateau dives into this canyon. And that drive, by the way, is just, it's got to be one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my life. And I've traveled to about 50 countries in my life. Yeah, I've seen a lot of stuff. And that canyon is just phenomenal. And that canyon's at about 8,000 to 9,000 feet above sea level, depending where you're at in it. And that has a whole bunch of little, like 400 case production wineries. I'd say there's probably like 30 or 40, if not more, but they're all teeny tiny. And they make it for each other. Like they basically just sell it domestically. And we're going to, for the first time this year, we this is one of the regions that we had recognized by the PTB. We'll be exporting that wine for the first time ever. And they have the longest tradition. They have probably one of the longest traditions in the Western Hemisphere. If it was documented, but it's not, unfortunately. But just, you know, knowing that all the wealth was in Cerro Rico and knowing this was the first valley to plant grapes, and that was the epicenter of Spanish wealth at the time, like it makes sense logically that would be one of the earliest sources of wine. But anyways, and then the third region is this beautiful region that's also so unique. It's also about kind of like 5,500 to 7,000 feet above sea level. And this region, yeah, I know, right? But this region is really interesting. It's called Samaipata. And this region is in the far eastern part of Bolivia, as one of the winemakers there likes to call it, the elbow of the Andes. And it juts into the Amazon. And I'm telling you, gentlemen, this is probably the only place, and you guys are probably the ones who'd be able to correct me if I'm wrong, but this is probably the only place in the world where you can be sipping wine on a vineyard and then 20 minutes later be diving into a tropical waterfall, which I've done, by the way. If I showed you the videos, man, it would blow your mind. There's nothing like it. On the other side of the mountain ridge is a national park in the Amazon. There's coffee on the other side of the mountain. Like, you know, you can't grow grapes where you can grow coffee. That's just a rule of thumb that I think you should all know. But anyways, so that's the third primary region. Now, my dad is from Cochabamba, which also has some grapes growing, but it doesn't have an Appalachian or anything. But we might get that fixed too, and we got to explore the quality first. But those are the three main regions: Samaipata, okay, Tarija, and the Sinti.
That's going from east to west, then, what you just
named.
That's
right. There. Yeah.
I'm looking at a map here while we were talking, trying to locate all that. Highway 7 seems to be the major road through everything.
But you would fly to these places. Like, the drives are very... My dad's in Bolivia right now, and he's going to be driving from Cochabamba to Santa Cruz and Samaipata. The roads are not always reliable, let's put it that way.
The climate in all those regions, are they all basically the same because of the elevation?
No, they're not. They're the same, and they have enough sameness to be grape growing regions, but the Samaipata is much more of a cool climate. So think, you know, kind of like Northwest sort of style. It doesn't quite get that heat that you would get in Tarija, which is where you get that more Mediterranean climate. It's a little warmer during the middle of the day. And then Sinti is probably more similar to Tarija, but it has less, it's a little less humid, a little drier. And it's a canyon. I mean, the thing about Sinti that's just crazy is it's not exaggerating. It's like having vineyards in a miniature Grand Canyon.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to explain until you get there. You know, it's this little narrow track of land that just is very long, like snakes through this canyon, and there's just vineyards all around it. Yeah, it's really cool.
Now this is interesting. I just thought about here. United States, we plant, get bud break in March, April. We harvest in August, September, because we're in the Northern Hemisphere. Australia, bud break in, you know, October, and they harvest in April, May, June, and they're in the Southern Hemisphere. But Bolivia is just basically in the center. So what is their growing season?
No, it's southern. It's totally southern. So they're picking grapes in January and February. The Sinti will pick grapes in March, early March, near the higher elevation. So it's on the southern schedule.
Well, that seems odd since the equator is just right there, basically, and it just seems odd that it would change immediately. I mean, it's just like, I never thought
of that. I don't know. Yeah, I wonder. I never thought of it. I wonder if it has something to do with like the moon or who knows. I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know. That just is strange because it's just right there. I mean, the grapes that are growing there. Okay, you mentioned native grape, but I noticed their tenant is the most common grape in Bolivia.
Well, the most common grape in Bolivia is the Muscat of Alexandria grape.
Oh.
And, yeah, by far. And part of the reason is because they use it to make Singani, which is a distilled spirit. It's a eau de vie, basically. And so that, you know, it's distilled from a white wine. They ferment it for 3 weeks. They take, it's 100% pure Muscat of Alexandria, fermented into for 3 weeks into a white wine, and then that's distilled into the spirit. And so that's a big consumer of grape, that spirit, and so that's a big one. Torrentes is very largely planted as well. Pedro Ximenez with a G, not the one for sherry, but the South American version of Pedro Ximenez, is also widespread there. But Tanat is the grape that has really adapted the best to elevation, and which makes sense, right? It's a hardy grape, and the reason why it is just this fantastic wine is Tanat is you know, naturally very tannic, right? you need a piece of red meat, or you need a bunch of water, and you know, to immediately chase it with, right? Otherwise, you're kind of like you know doing that awkward cat thing with your tongue on your mouth, and the elevation just rounds off those tannins to the point where you could actually take a bottle of just straight 100% snot and drink it as though it was a Cab Sauv or Syrah or something. Like, it's just very, very drinkable, and very approachable. And that's where Bolivia sort of made its mark, is their Tanat is just phenomenal. But, you know, the thing is that elevation affects all grapes. And so, you know, the 1750 Chardonnay, and I wonder if we even have any of that left. We are selling them that fast. But the 1750 Chardonnay, I would basically out. Is another one of those remarkable wines that, you know, it doesn't taste like any Chardonnay that you've probably had before, and it really, but it still is a Chardonnay. Like, you drink it and you're like, oh yeah, that's a Chardonnay, but man, is that different, you know?
Do they oak their wines there? Or?
Some do, some don't. Some don't. A general rule of thumb is it's oaked a lot less. And again, it's the elevation allows for that. Like, you know, part of the reason why the Tanat is so remarkable is that it barely touches oak. Whereas, you know, like a really good Tanat in France, you know, you're going to, or Uruguay, you're going to see a lot of oak to help soften it out and round it out. So generally they have less oak, but there's some wineries that do oak, some that don't.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at a, the Bolivian wine country, and it said that the grapes grown there, and they did not mention Tanat at all. They said Grenache, Shiraz, Cabernet, Chardonnay, Malbec, Merlot, and Pinot Noir, and that's it. You know, which and then the whites, Chenin Blanc, Riesling, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Merlot. Those aren't white. Oh, both red and whites, but they didn't mention.
Yeah, no, I mean. They do a ton. Like, we have Magnus, is a woman winemaker. She only makes about 2,000 cases of wine a year total. We have her Sangiovese. She was fond of Italian grapes, and she thought that they would do really well at elevation, and she was very correct. She's the only one making Sangiovese. But, you know, there's a bunch of, like, there's a bunch of varietals. We have a Cab Sauv, we have Syrah, we have several Cab Sauvs, we have Syrah, we have Merlot Blend, we have Sauv Blanc, you know, we have a Tanat Rosé, which is really interesting. 100% Tanat Rosé. Phenomenal.
Malbec.
Super fun wine.
Malbec.
There is Malbec, but we haven't brought any up yet.
Oh, really? No.
Yep. They have Malbec. We'll probably bring some up soon. We're going to bring up Sparkling this year. There's one winery making Sparkling, and it's fantastic. And we were so excited to pass the quality test, because you're like, oh my God, a bubbly from Bolivia. How cool is that?
What grape do you know?
Yeah, they we're bringing up a Brut, and we're bringing up a rosé, sparkling rosé. The rosé is a Tanat Muscadet of Alexandria blend.
Oh.
And the Brut is some of the more traditional French grapes: Zarello, Barriada, Pinot Blanc, Ugni Blanc.
Oh, okay. All right. Native Bolivian grapes. You said that they've been doing it for centuries. And
yeah.
What are some of the grapes that are native to Bolivia, and
yeah.
are they any good for wine?
Yeah. So the one that is there's I've heard stories of a bunch, right, up in these valleys, because they're all kind of hidden, these vineyards. But the one that I know of the that could potentially be the iconic grape of the country is the Circania. So this is one I was telling you about. This one, the story goes, no one really knows what it is, how it came to be as a grape. But the legend in Bolivia, at least, is that it's a cross between the Mission grape and the Muscat of Alexandria grape.
Oh.
And there's a beautiful story about, like, a donkey was, you know, taking some vines down near the Vistroca River in one of these valleys, and it tipped over, and the vines kind of, while it was crossing the bridge, and the vines sort of drifted down, and then, you know, a few years later, this community found these grapes that were growing along the banks, and it was this kind of weird hybrid grape, and it was really good, and it's the closest thing that we've been able to find to it is probably something like a Pinot Noir. It's best drink young. Oh. It's very light and refreshing. It's totally crushable, but it's just got this remarkable complexity, which is probably, you know, attributed to the elevation, because it makes the skin
right.
thicker. Yet it's naturally a lighter wine, a grape, I mean. So that one's really interesting. And then the Bolivia has a variation of the Mission grape, which they call Negra Criolla. And that's the grape that we recently got approved to use on a label. And so we hope to bring that up as well. I don't know if we'll be able to bring it up this year. That might be too short of a turnaround. But, and we'll keep finding more. And we'll keep registering them and telling the story and sharing the story and interest in the world of new grapes.
So wineries in Bolivia, how many? I mean, in all regions and everything, how many wineries are there?
It's a good question. It's probably somewhere around 50 commercial wineries, I'd say.
Oh, that many.
And you know, most of them are going to be under 1,000 cases production.
In the United States, that's the case too. There's not a whole lot of real big wineries. A lot of them are, you know, under,
mm-hmm.
under, you know, 5,000 cases. And so,
mm-hmm.
it's not
yeah.
unusual.
Yeah, 50 is probably on the high end. But there's only probably, and then again, quality is like a big piece of our puzzle for us, you know. And so, you know, the when you get to that, just like really knock your socks off, you know, good quality wines, you know, then the pot shrinks a little bit there.
Uh huh. How the vineyards? What's the size of most of the vineyards? What, only about 10, 15 acres? Is that about average?
Yeah, that's a good amount. And then there's a lot of small landholders too. So not I'd say about half. Well, let's see. We do have a few that are estate only. Mm-hmm. Some have just certain wines that are estate, but not their whole portfolio. But, you know, that's part of the development story for us. Is like one of the wineries we work with, Adam has, which is they're a sort of a pioneer. And they're the ones that won that first international gold medal for a Bolivian wine. And that's a funny
wow.
story, by the way. They didn't even, when they won the gold medal for their Tanat in 2013, they did it in Uruguay, which is, you know, the self-proclaimed champions of Tanat. And they won it in Montevideo. And the guy, they didn't even believe them. They didn't believe that the... That a Bolivian winemaker, a Bolivian winery would have such a good Tanat. They wouldn't give him the gold medal, so they went to the winery in Bolivia and tasted out of the same. And then they gave him the gold medal. there's a whole social commentary to get into. We need,
before we give you this medal, we need to taste the wine right here.
Yeah, I didn't say we don't believe you. Yeah, and that's so reflective of like of True Fly and like our, you know, it's a bit of an uphill battle. You got to like, you know, convince people, but you know, once they try it and they see it, then they're like, holy crap, yeah, this is real.
How many wines do you import from Bolivia?
We bring in, we have 26 different products right now.
Wow.
26 different kinds. Yeah.
Oh, and you mentioned it earlier, but I want to know more about the Singani. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah. So that's the 26. So we have 25 wines and one spirit. So this spirit is phenomenal. It's actually what we started with. We first started with the spirit. And then brought in the wines a year later, and the spirit is it's just remarkable because it's totally unaged. It doesn't touch wood at all, yet it has the complexity and the viscosity of an aged spirit, of like a cognac. You know, it's just this really aromatic. And part of the story there is again attributable to elevation. You know, the juice itself, right, is more aromatic because of the elevation from day one, like for just from the nature of the grape. And then when you're fermenting it and distilling it, which is, you know, part of that process is boiling, you're doing it at a lower temperature. Because the elevation is so darn high that the boiling temperature is lower, literally by a few degrees.
Right.
And so the whole process is less aggressive. And so you're retaining more of these complexities, these little nuances in the juice through that process. And that's, you know, that's what people, you know, Singani distillers like to say, is like, we don't need to age our stuff because it already tastes interesting. You know, like cognac, yeah, they gotta age it. You taste cognac out of the distillery, it's not very interesting. But if you put it in wood, then it becomes super complex and it's a fantastic spirit. They're like, we don't need to do that. Our thing is pure and beautiful. So it's fun. It's a really fun spirit. And I drink it straight on the rocks. Sometimes I'll put a little squeeze of lime in there just to add it. So citrus is a nice compliment. It basically replaces any clear spirit, any gin, any traditional cocktail you've ever had. The first cocktail that was ever made with it of our spirit in the United States was a Negroni.
What is the ABV on the Centauri?
It's 40%.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right up there, right up there with the others.
It's a big one, but it's as smooth as they come. Our the guy that makes it, Johnny is his name, Saguero, his story is amazing too. The distiller, he literally sleeps in the still during that, because you know it's not like a grain spirit where you can just kind of make it all year round,
right?
Or like a gin that you can make all year round. You make it with the harvest, right? I mean, it's all linked because you have to ferment the grapes into a wine. And then you have, you're only fermenting for 3 weeks. So then you have to go and start the distillation process, right? You know, pretty soon thereafter. So you can't just like do it whenever you want. You have a time of year that you're distilling. So it's very aligned with the grape cycle. And so during that process is intense, you know? And so he stays in the still, you know, with the still and sleeps overnight and kind of keeps that. It's awesome. He's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful spirit. Yeah. It's a very beautiful spirit. Particularly theirs. I mean, it's like everything, right? There's every country can make, you know, bad wines are equally distributed around the world. So are bad.
Oh yeah.
And you know, there's definitely some, when I was a kid, probably younger than I should have been, my cousins would, you know, get me to try all the Singanis, and it wasn't the good stuff. Let's just put it that way.
We always start with the best, though. Yeah, always.
So it's nice now. My wife and I sip on this really fine Singani. It's called Rojera Singani. And, you know, we sip on this fantastic Singani, honestly. Yeah. It was better than when I was a kid in Bolivia.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mike, any questions or anything, comments to Ramon here you'd like to make?
I just saw on your website on the shop the shop page that your wine prices are very, very good, very affordable, at least it's showing in dollars. I'm guessing that's U.S.
Yep.
dollars.
Yep.
What is your distribution? If someone was to order on the website, do you ship only within the country, or can you ship out to anywhere?
We're in the U.S. We ship to the 44 states that allow it. And that's it. I mean, it's been great. I mean, this whole moving to the platform has been wonderful because we've been able to really connect with our consumers directly and our customers and people who are interested in these stories. Yeah. You know, we do wine tastings all the time with different groups. Like I said, my partner is doing one with GW Alumni tonight. In 2 weeks, we're doing one with the Rainforest Trust. It's a fundraiser for a project in Bolivia. It's really awesome. I've done it with the Vintner Project. Like we love just telling the story and sharing it, and it really does people connect with it. And so, they are affordable wines for the quality. It's remarkable. It really is.
Yeah. Very good. I noticed that. And I saw Bolivia on a, this is probably not, it's not related to wine, but you were talking about the canyons and the drive and all that. And I remember it was either on Discovery or on Netflix, like the most dangerous roads in the world. And I forgot North Youngest or something or Young.
The Youngest.
I don't know how you
say it. Yeah, the Youngest. Yeah, the Youngest.
Oh my
God.
You got like a one in half chance of making it across, and these people are still going across. I'm like, that's not very good odds. And
no.
I'm just looking. This road, this path, it's incredible, and I can't see how anybody can do that. But that was in there, and that just brought me up when you were talking about getting through the canyons and all that. I thought, no way.
Yeah. There, let's put it this way. We've taken a lot of people down there now, influencers and investors and different people. And we're probably going to do another one. I think we might invite our wine club members to come down to one of them. But when we take folks down there, we obviously avoid those things. The good news in Bolivia is that the flights are cheap internally, so we just take the flights between the cities and stick to the venues. We definitely go to tropical waterfalls, like that part happens, but that's very safe and fun.
I was looking at that road and it was like, oh my gosh, that thing goes through mountains and valleys and the sides of mountains and all sorts of stuff on the map. Tell us, Ramon, tell us about your website, how to get in touch with you, how to order from you, if anyone wants to. Give us all the information so our listeners out there can this out. I mean, it's just...
I appreciate it's that. Great. I always forget about this deep. I get so excited about the impact mission and the tradition and the history that I forget to let people know how to participate. And so we're at chufly.com, which is chufly.com. And you can just go right to our shop, pick your wines. We have this wonderful pack. It's called Wines of Bolivia. It's a little exploratory pack. It's a good little selection of the different styles of wine from the different regions. And then, you can find what style you like, and then you can go and explore further with that winemaker or that region. We also are doing a thing with the Rainforest Trust, which might be an interesting way to do it. We have a psalm that does a professionally guided tasting of the wine, so we can really kind of discover that. And then I give a little spiel on our impact thesis. And it's a fun way to kind of get to know the wines a little bit better and explore them that way. If you know what grapes you like, what style of wines you like, and just, get a few bottles and pop them open, share them with some friends. It's a fun story to tell people. You can always show up to someone's house, and I guarantee you show up with a Bolivian wine and be like, hey, I bet you've never had this. And you're probably going to be right. A lot of our wines, pretty much every one of our wines, with maybe one or two exceptions, are probably less than 1,000 cases production. There's no bulk juice here. Nothing. No bulk.
There's on these sites too. The website here. I have to add that the prices, like Mike said, are really reasonable. And it's broken down into the regions and stuff, too. So if you're looking at getting from one particular region, but I think the best thing would be, just like Ramon said there, the Wines of Bolivia pack. It's a six-pack, and it's only $120, $119.99. And that's a great deal. I mean, you can just start there and just go from there, start ordering from the others. Where is the list of the states you cannot ship to, or the ones you can? I don't see it here.
Yeah, it's in the FAQ. I think it's buried somewhere in there. We got to do a better job of that. We're about to revamp the website, launch a new one, and that part is going to be a lot clearer. We do not ship to Utah, Alabama, Alaska, I believe. And there's a I can't remember. Arkansas.
Yeah, it's probably
There's like six states that are just it's a no go zone. And
yeah, the same six states that don't like people to ship to them no matter what. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Utah is actually a felony, I heard.
Utah's they're ridiculous. They really are. They are absurd there. I've talked to wineries in Utah, and even the wineries in Utah say they're absurd here. You know, I mean, it's just everybody knows it. You know, same thing with Alabama and what is the other one there? Mississippi, I think, was another one that was really crazy.
Mississippi, too. Yeah.
And Kansas has got some pretty strict rules and stuff. Yeah, but Utah is right up there at the top of that list. But all right, everybody, check it out, Chufly, CHUFLY.com. Very simple, very easy, but great wines. And you can also order that Singani on there. There's down at the bottom of the page, you can order a bottle of the Singani and have that. What are your shipping costs?
We do $20 flat rate. And then free shipping on any order over $149.
Wow.
So we try to make it super, super reasonable. Yeah, our mission is to try to spread the word, share the word. So we're willing to do our best to make sure that we can get in as many people's hands as possible that appreciate this type of thing.
Yeah, that is a good price on that shipping too. Fantastic. Anything else, Mike, before we say goodnight to Ramon?
Not really. If anybody's interested, definitely go to the website, the Rainforest Trust Virtual Wine Fundraiser. It takes place at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, June 30th. So time is running out. Get on the website now. And they do accept PayPal, which is awesome. So you got choices. That's always a good choice for some people. But Wednesday, June 30th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time is the Rainforest Trust Virtual Wine Fundraiser, and go to the website like Ron and Ramon said, and check it out. Register.
Great.
Get busy right now. Thank you. Perfect.
Well, gentlemen, thank you. Thank you so much for taking an interest in our story and our mission.
Oh,
I sincerely appreciate it.
Yeah.
It was very, very interesting. It was fascinating and informative. I really enjoyed it. And best of luck to you in your ventures and finding new countries. When you find yourself a new country, a new small country that we've never tasted wines from, let us know. We'll get you back on again. You can tell us about that one, too.
That sounds great.
All
right. Thanks a lot. Have yourself a good evening.
You too, man. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. All right.
There we go.
That was interesting. Bolivian wines. Who had ever thought? Like I said, tell me of South American wines, Chile and Argentina. Anything else? Nope, that's it. Who would ever consider Bolivian wines? And they're reasonable too. I mean, he and you know, flat rate $20 and free after $149. You can get yourself the Bolivian taster pack for $120 and buy yourself a Sengani for $30, and you've passed that free shipping mark and you've got yourself some good taste there. So there you go, people. Just, you know, jump on it. And that's for a good cause.
Definitely.
I mean, the,
yep.
What the all of it helps, you know, sustain and support and the country and the winemaking regions and all that there. And so, yeah, that was interesting. And I hope he finds some new little countries and, you know, we can get him on again and let us tell about those different ones too. So, great.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I don't see anything else on the agenda other than we'll be back next Thursday. That's June 24th. Don't forget, Ron is going to, well, I don't know, you're going to be recording. Probably.
I'll be recording.
I don't
know when it's going to air. Yeah.
Yeah. Monday, June 21st. So he'll be doing that. And we'll be back here on All About Wine on June 24th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And
we do have a guest. Worldwide.
Yes, we do have a guest. And stay tuned to social media and we'll tell you more about it when the time comes. So,
yeah. And
thank you all.
Happy Father's Day. Daddy's grandpa's, all the fathers out there, happy Father's Day. That's coming up on Sunday. So hope you all have yourself a wonderful day. And everybody trying to think of a present for Dad, wine. Always, always a good present, wine.
Works. So. That's right. So drink up and toast, share a glass, whatever you got to do.
Right.
We'll see you all next week. Thanks
for joining us.
Be safe. Thank you. We'll see you.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
Thank you.